G'day, dear listeners. Welcome to a week of repeats on Linlel. Today, a show broadcast earlier this year, which talks about two very different types of races, the one to space and the one for survival. The first focuses on the space race and how we're going to regulate it in an age when access to space has become almost an everyday occurrence and there's getting to be a bit of a traffic jam up there. What laws govern that vast universe? And in the second interview, very much set on Earth, takes us to California, where a drought has been underway for years now and getting deeper by the day. The lessons California is learning and sometimes choosing not to learn, they're a good template for the likes of us, where we too need to watch over our diminishing resources and treasure every drop of the wet stuff. I hope you enjoy listening to both interviews. Now, as I often point out, there's a lot of junk around. There's junk food and there's junk television and there's junk bobbing about in space. Humans have been travelling well to outer space briefly, to inner space for over 50 years, and we've already trashed the place. For years, NASA has been tracking over 500,000 bits of space junk, and just last week, researchers from the University of Southampton found another 50,000 pieces to add to that number. I think many of them were shopping trolleys. And all this looks set to get worse because an increasing number of perhaps less accountable actors, from small tech startups to recalcitrant corporations, look set to enter the space race. Like all global commons, like the ocean or Antarctica, space needs a way to be governed, and it seems the laws we have in place are woefully out of date. And one of the key problems is that they're heavily state-centric and would struggle to regulate the private interests that may do the most harm. Now, to discuss this issue, I'm joined by two gentlemen from the RAND Corporation, and I have to say, this is the first time in my 25 years at this microphone I've ever spoken to anyone from RAND. When I was a teenage Bolshe, we constantly demonised RAND because it was the organisation that gave us that wonderful notion of MAD, M-A-D, nuclear deterrence by mutually assured destruction. And I used to go to bed at night having nightmares about Herman Kahn, who was the chief strategist, because it was he that posited the idea of a winnable nuclear war. And he pops up, or rather he morphs into Dr. Strangelove. He's one of the threads that created that character for the Kubrick movie. These days, however, it is absolutely and utterly respectable. It has a vast number of employees, probably one of the biggest groups of research scientists the world has ever amassed. In fact, the last time I looked at the figures there, there were simply scores of Nobel laureates. I'm joined on this occasion by Dave Bioking. He's a senior engineer with RAND, and Bill Welser, who's director of the Engineering and Applied Sciences Department at RAND as well. So Dave and Bill, welcome to our little wireless program.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Thanks.
Dave, hundreds of privately owned satellites in space. How many? How many hundreds? Do we know?
We don't. The numbers are still low because we're still in the early stages of the concept of a privately owned satellite. You know, for years, at the beginning of the space race, you know, it was primarily just between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Getting to space was very expensive, and the only way you could do it was if it was funded by, you know, deep pockets, and that deep pockets were in government. Recently, however, the costs of going to space have been declining for three primary reasons, which I'm happy to get into. And as a result of that, private companies are now actually being able to identify business plans that will get them to space and potentially make a profit once they get there.
Dave, I know that many of these are operated by phone companies, internet providers, cable TV networks. But why is the price of entry dropping so dramatically? What are the factors?
So there's really three factors that are leading to what we're calling the democratization of space. The first is that electronics have become miniaturized over the last few years, and by few, I mean the last few decades. You know, today's iPhone has the computational power of a supercomputer from the late 80s, And so because the phones that we're all carrying around in our pockets are so capable, you really can put a lot of electronic capability up in orbit in a really tiny space. And in addition, they're also really energy efficient. And so in the old days, maybe you needed a lot of power, which is an issue in space. Today, you have a lot of computational power that runs and draws a very small amount of electricity. So the fact that we have this miniaturization of electronics means we can send up a lot of capability. The second thing, or the second factor, is that we're able to make easy one-off parts. You know, when you make a space satellite, you're not building something that's been made on an assembly line. This is something that's made in the lab. Often, space satellites are what we call sort of onesie-twosie, so it's just a one-off or a two-off part. You're not making hundreds of them for the most part. And so, as a result, you know, the traditional fabrication methods that we use for pretty much everything else in our life, where we're making it at scale, don't really lend themselves very well to making satellites. So the technology that's enabled this is 3D printing. And so I'm not talking about the 3D printing that, you know, the 3D printers that are available at your local, even hobby shop now. I'm talking about sort of the industrial versions that you can get for $35,000 or $40,000 US. And what this allows you to do is very effectively and very inexpensively just make one part. You don't have to stand up a complicated assembly line like you did in the old days. And so this 3D printing sort of paradigm lends itself really well to space satellites. And the third factor that's allowing space to become more democratized is the fact that we're getting much lower cost launch solutions. So in the old days, if you wanted to go to space, you had to pay a ton of money, and likely a government enterprise would put you on a rocket. Today, again, because more just private citizens and private companies are entering the race, launch providers see a business opportunity there, and they're building smaller rockets because people are actually willing to pay to get their smaller satellites launched. And so now there is you can spend a modest amount of money and get your satellite up into space. So all three of these factors are lowering the cost of entry. And so as a result, we're seeing things like small satellites on Kickstarter, so crowdfunded satellites, or even new startups in Silicon Valley are starting to develop their own constellations.
Now, Bill, if one was to look into the future, you might postulate, well, I'm going to, and you can knock me down, that just as the drone went from being a tool of trade, a tool of war for governments, and is now ubiquitous with everyone flying the damn things around public parks, that this process of miniaturization and privatization, democratization, might also have one's neighbor launching a little satellite.
You could definitely speculate that that might happen. I think more importantly than that, in the developing world, you could see a shift away from trying to build the typical infrastructure, the needs for phone lines and whatnot, and toward, you know, rapidly being able to modernize an area of the world that is vastly without infrastructure. That to me is very exciting and maybe a bit more powerful than the neighbor having a satellite.
We're going into panic mode. We should be exhilarated by the potential, by the chances that are offered.
I think the positive side potential far outweighs some of the negative things that we might postulate that could happen from nefarious actors or people who are trying to make problems in the world, if you will.
Now, Dave, the laws, however, that currently regulate, if that's the appropriate word, regulate the cosmos, only apply to national governments because of the origins of the space race.
That's right. So, again, when the space race started, it was just two players. It was the U.S. and the Soviet Union. And so we have an international space treaty, but that was developed, again, when the only players were large superpowers. And so the space treaty is very good. It lays out a lot of it lays a good foundation, and I don't think it needs to be scrapped. However, parts of it either are undeveloped or haven't been tested yet. So as an example, if a private citizen were to launch a satellite completely private without government funding, The space treaty currently says that the launching country, so whichever landmass the rocket leaves from, that is the country that is held liable for however that satellite behaves in space. And you could imagine some scenarios where, you know, that might lead to some potential conflict. And the bottom line is that we have some basic frameworks in place, but none of it's really been tested yet. And coming up with the norms and running through a few test cases when these situations actually present themselves is going to, we will see this in the coming years, and it's going to be a challenge.
Are test cases surfacing, and if so, which jurisdiction are they assessed in?
Well, I don't want to speak out of turn and dig deeply into a test case, but I do want to, if I could, generalize. Is that okay?
Sure.
Great. So we, you know, part of the great part of the fun of working at RAND, if you will, is that we get a chance to talk with a lot of different stakeholders. And in our discussions with the United Nations Office of Outer Space Affairs, they're very excited right now because of this movement, because more people are paying attention to regulating space or thinking about whether or not space should be regulated is probably a better way to state it. And it's getting more people involved. So the test cases are actually coming out of the woodwork, whereas before, people kind of shoved them to the side and didn't think too much about them. With the increase in the number of players, you can't really shove it aside anymore.
Okay. Large companies like Virgin and SpaceX have been operating in the private market for years, but they're now being joined by a range, as you say, of tiny startups. What sort of work are the little businesses carrying out, Bill?
So right now, it really ranges, and I would call them anybody of the smaller companies, anybody who sells you something more than the fact that they're doing testing of test cases, if you will, they're being disingenuous. I mean, really, the small startups are just trying to test the waters to see what kind of applications might be built, what kind of capabilities could be delivered from space. And that there are just as many failures out there as there are successful examples. So I would say we're in this kind of exploratory phase right now, where people are trying to see what can you do with these smaller satellites and constellations of the smaller satellites.
Dave, so one of the startups you point to is Tyvek Nano Satellite Systems. It employs just 24 engineers. Aims to build satellites so inexpensive that practically anyone can buy and launch them, unquote. How cheap are we talking at this time?
So I don't want to speak directly for them, but I am under the impression that they can build a base system for about, I think it's a little bit under $50,000. So, you know, that's about the cost, U.S. dollars. So that's about the cost of a, you know, a mid-level automobile, a little bit of luxury, right? But that is within the reach of a significant portion of the U.S. population, at least. Now, it's important to recognize that we're not talking about sort of the school bus-sized satellites that that governments typically build and send up. These are small systems. So the ones that Tyvek builds in particular are built on a unit that is 10 centimeters along a side. So they can send up one of those, or that's sort of the base unit is at 10 centimeters along the side. So I'm not going to get into the technical part on that. Sorry.
So you're talking something about the size of a loaf of bread.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, I wanted to add to what Bill said earlier is this is where the small startups are making their difference. You know, they recognize that, again, the governments are building sort of the Cadillacs that we're putting into space, these extremely complicated machines that are capable of doing just amazing things. The thing, they're the
Dave,
aspect of
could you
of
come
this,
a bit closer to the mic? You're slightly off. Thanks.
The aspect of the space industry that hasn't been addressed as much by government investment directly are these smaller systems. And so this is where we're seeing the new startups participate, is in building these smaller satellites. And so the exciting part that Bill mentioned earlier is that we're starting to see people use these small satellites in ways that you would never use a large satellite. So, for example, you know, the small startups can't afford to send up something that's the size of a city bus. Okay, great. But instead, they could send up maybe 100 little breadbox-sized satellites, and that opens up an entirely new mission. So maybe you don't need really great resolution on something, and you won't get really great resolution on something that's the size of a breadbox. But if you have 100 of them in orbit, you get much better coverage over the Earth than if you just have one or two.
Now, gentlemen, I have to tell you that listening to this program are criminal groups and probably people involved in terror. Aren't they potential launches as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely they are. And, you know, as with anything else in our society right now, it's not just being able to procure and launch the hardware, but it's being able to, you know, hack in to the software of these on-orbit capabilities. So that's something that I might pay more attention to, which is protecting the software access, protecting the control of these satellites once they are on orbit.
You know, it's really...
Sorry.
I was just going to add, it's really similar to what we're seeing in the smartphone market, right? You know, when smartphones or when the app stores in particular were opened up on both the Android and the iPhone platform, that opened up a huge window for new innovation. We're using our phones today in ways that we never would have thought possible, in ways that Apple or Google would have never thought possible when they designed the operating systems. Now, the flip side of that is that our phones can collect data on us, and I'm sure that that's being used in nefarious ways. This is the flip side that comes whenever a new technology window is opened. So we're seeing it in the smartphone market right now, and we're reacting as a result. There's public conversations about the meaning of privacy and what do we own and what do we not. And we imagine, Bill and I imagine, that we're going to see the same thing happen in a conversation related to space once it starts to open up as well.
Okay, let's now take another direction here and go to the question of junk. Dave, tens of thousands of man-made objects orbiting the Earth, from functioning satellites to space junk, whizzing around at breakneck speed. Is it possible to keep track of all this stuff? I made the point that just in the last few days, another 50,000 have been discovered. Would that be the grand total, or might there be an immense number of other bits that even Rand doesn't know about?
So there's an immense number of things in space, and honestly, we're never going to have a handle on all of it. So I'd like to think about space debris as sort of two different classes of objects. There's a class of objects that are large enough for us to be able to detect using our sensors on the ground, and by our, I mean the various governments. So the U.S. government, for example, has a network of debris sensors scattered throughout the globe, as do other countries. And in general, these sensors can see things that are about the size of a softball or a grapefruit or larger. And for everything that's smaller than that, we really don't have a good way to track it. The way that we usually, so for objects that are about the size of, you know, maybe dusts of sand or grains of salt on that order, you know, those calculations are all done empirically. They're done statistically. The debris populations of these really tiny objects are calculated using models. It's not that we have a sensor. It's not that we have sensors, just because the laws of physics won't allow us to be able to see these tiny grains of sand. So if you talk about objects that are about the size of a softball or larger, we're looking at tens of thousands of objects. If you go all the way down to something that's maybe the size of a grain of sand, potentially an infinite number or a near infinite number.
Dave, we can't look to some form of outer spatial biodegradability, I guess.
That's right. So, you know, when you launch a satellite now, there's a best practice that you should have a plan for how to deorbit your satellite when it's done. So when it's done performing its mission. So the UN, this is a norm that's been instituted by the member states of the UN, have all agreed that every satellite should have a plan. And if you're in a low Earth orbit, so these are the satellites that do weather or they do imaging for the purpose of Google Maps, that sort of thing. So those are in a low enough orbit that at the end of their life, you can fire the thrusters and it will move towards the atmosphere and it will burn up upon reentry.
That's well, that is really a form of biodegradability, isn't it?
Yeah, that's I love it. Yes. Yes, you're right. And for the stuff that's way out there, like the communication satellites, for example, that are too far out to be able to move them back towards Earth. What they do is they actually push them farther out away from their current orbit into what they call a garbage orbit or a parking orbit, where they just, for now, will sit until the end of time.
I am at liberty to reveal to you, gentlemen, to you, Bill and Dave, that Australia is working on a huge vacuum cleaner, which which we hope to launch within the decade. Could that be feasible, incidentally, Bill?
So it is definitely feasible to launch some type of vacuum cleaner-like technology, but I would question the return on investment. Space, I think one thing that people forget when they're thinking about space debris is that space is still really, really big. And while we don't want to continue to pollute the environment, and we want to try to avoid collisions and act responsibly in the environment, we don't necessarily need to spend billions of dollars to go get a couple pieces of space debris.
Well, Australia's colleague in this, Mr. Dyson, will be terribly, terribly unhappy.
I know, and I'm so sorry. And I love his vacuum cleaners, but but I do think that we need to better characterize the environment and be honest with ourselves about where our risk threshold is. Right now, you know when you look at the amount of debris on orbit, it's kind of always shown as an always ever increasing slope. And yes, that is true, but we could still be in the stage where it's just in the noise. And if we act responsibly from here on out, we would be fine.
Bill, I want to put a question to you. I'd like to frighten the listener as far as possible. Tell me what would happen if a couple of significant satellites collided. Might this not, in fact, cause huge chaos back on Earth with so much of our economy relying on space-based infrastructure? I understand that if I pay with a credit card, I'm engaging with atomic clocks fixed to GPS satellites.
You are. I mean, Dave and I, in a joking way, always say that people will start paying attention to space when a DirecTV satellite is taken out during the Super Bowl. but in answer to your question, a lot of our everyday lives, there's focus on space systems and space system kind of reliance, if you will. So you already mentioned the time stamping for banking is really important. Cell phones use it as well. We talk a lot with, as I said, various organizations and agencies. Post-2020, all aircraft are going to be really reliant upon GPS. Right now, there's a great connection with the ground stations and the ground stations telling the aircraft where they are, but more and more reliance on space systems. And that's tough because you can't reach out and maintain a space system that falls in disrepair. They're very expensive to get up there in the first place. And then once they're up there, it's really hard to maintain them.
Is there any redundancy built into the systems as there is into a major aircraft?
So absolutely. There's radiation hardening. And now at this point, we're talking about the big, exquisite satellites that governments put up or large multinational firms put up. There's radiation hardening. There's they try to avoid single points of failure within the critical path of technology, if you will. And then for big constellations like GPS, I mean, you have many, many satellites, and then you have satellites that are kind of waiting in orbit in case something goes wrong with one of the ones that's being currently operated and relied upon. Now, with the smaller satellites that we were talking about at the beginning, many of those are being launched without any radiation hardening. I mean, think about them in a disposable camera kind of sense. They're one-time use and then, re-enter the Earth's atmosphere kind of thing. And those, are much far less resilient, if you will, to things like single point of failure or the space environment.
Dave, I introduced you by talking about the history of RAND Corporation, and of course, it is closely affiliated with the military. The military, as must be terribly concerned about the problems you're describing are surely they're putting on international pressure to tidy things up, both legislatively and physically.
Yes, absolutely. You know, one thing that we're involved in is that we recognize that the first step to solving this problem is just being aware of what's up there. And so, you know, the U.S. Air Force, in fact, is the entity in the U.S. government that keeps track of our catalog, and by our, I mean the U.S.'s catalog of objects in space. So the network is managed by the Air Force, and the people who run the calculations and who provide the expertise to the U.S. government all sit in military outfits. And the reason for that is that they recognize that having the custody, being able to identify these objects and keep track of them as they move around, is the first step towards solving the problem. And so as a result, the military has taken that mission on.
We'll all know who to blame if and when the Super Bowl goes off air. It'll clearly be Dave and William seeking to publicise their cause. Thank you very much, gentlemen. My guests have been Dave Bioking, a senior engineer at the RAND Corporation, and William Welser, director of the Engineering and Applied Sciences Department at RAND as well. And I understand that one of my guests would like to say something about Herman Kahn before we leave.
So I just don't want, thank you, Philip, I just don't want people to walk away keeping in their mind Mutually Assured Destruction and the RAND Corporation. And I would just like to say that another great person at the RAND Corporation, James Drake, in 1969 developed windsurfing. So, I mean, I think that's a nice contrast to Mutually Assured Destruction. There are some good things that the RAND Corporation has done that it benefits everyone.
Well, I feel like signing up now. I'll fly over and join the team. Thank you very much, gentlemen. LNL on RN and all sorts of space age platforms. And coming up, When the Water Runs Out in California. As I said earlier in the program, we've got fairly futile wars on drugs and on terror, but the war we're fighting on water, the undeclared war on water, that's a roaring success, and water is conspicuously losing all over the planet. The El Nino announced today, adding to our troubles as in Australian agriculture. Mind you, Australian agriculture is one of the reasons we have a problem. It's not all climate change and it's not all the mining industry. But California, boy, are they copping it. A couple of months back, the LA Times ran an article by a professor billed as the Al Gore of the water crisis, who reckons California runs out of stored water, that's water in reservoirs, in a year. And he helms a system called GRACE, and this links back to our previous story about the things you can do with satellites, which for the first time is able to map and measure groundwater from space. And he says that thinking about water thus is a good idea. Rain and snow make up our income, stored water is what we spend, and groundwater and aquifers are our savings. But now we have no income, we're spending like crazy, and we're digging into our savings. Now, with that thought resonating, let's go to California and talk about the crisis. This month, State Governor Jerry Brown enforced the most sweeping water regulations to date, though anyone who takes notice of them, well, we're not sure that they will. 94% of Californians now agree that the drought is very serious, but only a third of them support restrictions. They're not the only ones to blame. As we head towards another drought cycle here, the world at large has this serious problem with taking the issue of water seriously. With me today is Mark Hertzgaard, an environmental journalist and the author of a book called Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. And Mark's been studying the problem of water in California and beyond, and he joins us now from his home in San Francisco. Mark, welcome to our little wireless program. And a simple question is, San Francisco as beleaguered as Los Angeles?
No, San Francisco is actually relatively well positioned, partly because of an act of theft over 100 years ago. San Francisco, the city fathers here in the early 20th century, essentially stole water. For the first time in American history, they managed to get inside of a national park, in Yosemite National Park, as it happens, and they essentially dammed up a second valley in Yosemite National Park and created a permanent water supply for the city and county of San Francisco. And that, along with the fact that San Francisco has had a very affirmative and proactive policy of water conservation, means that the city of San Francisco is relatively well situated here compared to the rest of California and certainly Los Angeles. Los Angeles gets most of its water from hundreds and hundreds of miles away through a vast and complex series of aqueducts and canals that stretch all the way to the northern edge of the state.
In tribute to your appearance, I played the theme from Chinatown at the beginning of the program. It's time, I think, to get Roman Polanski back and make a sequel.
Yes, well, there is, you know, there's water is essentially the history of California. And there's a famous line that is attributed to Mark Twain. Scholars differ as to whether he actually said it, but Mark Twain famously supposedly said way back in the day that in California, whiskey is for drinking and water is for fighting over.
Oh, dear, oh, dear. Well, of course, some people have lost the fight already. Some Californians have run out of drinking water altogether. And yet others continue to water their lawns and grow water-thirsty crops and take prodigiously long showers. Why did Brown take so long to announce water restrictions? This is simply because of the laissez-faire attitude that Americans so often have and a hatred of regulation.
You know, I think that's an excellent question, and Governor Brown has not addressed us in the media about that very much. He and his aides would say, hey, wait, we are the first public officials in California history ever to issue mandatory water restrictions, and that is correct. His restrictions that were announced on April 1st were the very first mandatory restrictions. It had been voluntary before that. That said, many critics, and myself included, pointed out that the restrictions were very limited. 80% of the water in California, the developed water, that is the available water, is consumed by the agriculture sector. Only 20% is consumed by urban and suburban residential customers. And yet Governor Brown's restrictions only applied to the urban sector. That's 20% of the problem, and that's important. But there is simply, the laws of mathematics tell you there is no way you can solve this problem if you leave 80% of the issue off the table. And Governor Brown so far has not forced that. His executive order, I should say, in fairness to the governor, his executive order does require the water agencies in the agricultural districts to issue and formulate quote-unquote plans.
It's interesting that one of his improbable predecessors, Schwarzenegger, was very bold and took a lot of initiatives on the issue of climate change at a time when it was, well, I know it's still being talked down in the US, and here's Brown with much more progressive credentials, but he's buckling to the to the power of industrial agriculture. You write about Stuart Resnick, who runs a huge commercial concern, Paramount Farms, and he's an illustration of the problems that regulators in general face, and I suppose Jerry Brown in particular.
Yes, well, Mr. Resnick is a well-known billionaire and I must say, a speculator in water. He managed to game the system such that he's gotten a hold of a lot of water, and I wrote in the Daily Beast, as you mentioned, the Daily Beast website, that he and his big agriculture cohorts are literally, as one of them said in my piece, smiling all the way to the bank because they are making record profits, and not just because agriculture prices are high, record profits because they are planting record acreage of almonds, of alfalfa, of walnuts.
But these are very thirsty crops.
very thirsty crops. And they're able to get away with that because the water system in California is not only complex, but it is basically biased towards the biggest users. And there is no one price. And what you hear as a reporter, if you talk to water experts, pretty much every one of them will tell you that the basic answer is that we have to price water realistically. And right now, the water is priced inexpensively. And let me just make one thing clear here. I grew up on a farm. I am a farm boy. I am not slamming agriculture. I'm not slamming farmers. They work hard. It's a tough business. But there is a difference between the big farmers like Stuart Resnick, who are literally laughing all the way to the bank, growing alfalfa and walnuts that they're exporting to China, and the people that you mentioned earlier, Philip, on this broadcast, the farm workers out in the Central Valley, who literally now are without water. Their kitchen sinks are spitting up mud because they can't get water. Why is that? Because as the drought has continued, the biggest farmers are drilling deeper and deeper wells down into the groundwater supplies, and they are raiding that groundwater to keep their operations going. But as a result, the poor mom and pops and the individuals who just have small, shallow household wells, they're out of luck.
Well, in Australia, I have to tell you that farmers have learnt to adjust to apparently endless and deepening droughts, and now every drop is precious. But it's his Resnick, who's, of course, a big, not only a great marketer, as you point out, but also a big donor to political campaigns. I understand he even got Stephen Colbert to sign up.
Isn't that something? Yeah, I was struck by that, because, of course, Stephen Colbert is a very, at least on the air, that comes across as a very progressive-minded individual. He's a Sunday school teacher. He has actually done shows where he went out into the fields and worked as a farm worker to try and illustrate how difficult that job is. And yet, for the football Super Bowl here in 2014, what did you see if you tuned in the commercials during that Super Bowl but none other than Stephen Colbert in a commercial for Stuart Resnick's pistachios?
Naughty Stephen. We shall cast him into outer darkness. The last story, as I mentioned to you, was about the space race, the new space race to launch satellites. You're talking about an agricultural arms race. One of the manifestations of this is your image of desperate farmers drilling ever deeper, you know, to find water. Are there other aspects to the agricultural arms race?
I think that's the main one that we can see visibly. But you you alluded to another one earlier, which is the political spending and the political influence of these individuals. Because it is a baffle to me why not just Governor Brown, but politicians in general in the state capital of Sacramento, why do they continue to let big agriculture get away with this? You know, California, sure, it's an agricultural state. It's an important part of our economy, but it's only 2% of our economy. Should 2% of the economy use 80% of the water? That just cannot be right. And yet there is this perception in Sacramento that big ag is too big to cross.
Mark, we're dealing with a new phenomenon, as well as vast areas of traditional coal mining. Many of us, my fellow farmers, are being confronted by fracking. Is that going on to a large extent in California?
I've done a lot of reporting on fracking here in California. It is going on, not to a large extent, although not for lack of trying or government restrictions. The main problem is that the geology of California, which of course is famously earthquake prone, the geology of California is not conducive to fracking. It could be worked out eventually, but you know, most fracking, it's like you drill straight down and you break through the rock underneath, way underneath, and you free the hydrocarbons. In California, as one of my sources said, the underground topography, if you will, is more like a bowl of nachos or corn chips. It cuts this way and that way. And so basically, the oil industry hasn't figured out how to do it yet at scale. That said, fracking has been going on in California for many years, and Governor Brown is facing a lot of criticism about this from environmental and climate activists who, on the whole, point out and applaud what the governor has done, because Jerry Brown, building on Schwarzenegger's record, has now gotten to a point where clearly California is by far the most ambitious and far-reaching and effective climate policies in the United States. But there is an asterisk to that record. I call it the fracterisk to that record, that Jerry Brown has still not come out against fracking. And of course, fracking does use an enormous amount of water. Each well takes about anywhere from 2 to 8 million gallons, million that is, gallons of water.
Are there any plans to build large desal plants, given that you've got an awful lot of sunshine and an awful lot of ocean?
Yes, the city of San Diego is building a desalinization plant, and it's an indication both of the desperation of people, but also the lack of information. The real solution to our water crisis in California, and it's something, frankly, that some of our experts have gone to Australia on fact-finding missions to learn about, but also our own scientists have pointed out, the real solution is water efficiency. More efficient irrigation, what they call drip irrigation, properly timed irrigation, spray irrigation, all of these methods. And there's a study that I quoted in my Daily Beast article that Pacific Institute, which is world renowned on water and climate issues, and they pointed out that if the farmers of California use simply the currently available irrigation technologies, we could have reduced the amount of water consumed in 2013 by 23%. And that would have been enough to basically offset the entire effects of the drought for the agricultural sector. Now, half of the farmers in California have already initiated these kinds of efficiency programs, so good on them. But there's still another half who have not even gotten started with this. And I think that's really where the solutions are going to be, because desalinization is just huge.
Oh, look, I'm not advocating it, but it is a panic response. We've had a few built here, and once they're up and running, they switch them off because it rains, and then they're just a huge drain on the budgets. And, of course, even when operational, they're not exactly climate change friendly. What about water recycling too? Is that being advocated?
That is, and that is that's showing great advances. But that so far is mainly in the urban areas, especially down in Southern California. And I think that the Governor Brown's new regulations are going to vastly accelerate that. Again, only in the urban and the rural areas. That said, there is great scope for doing that in the rural areas. In fact, I just today saw an article, probably the smartest thing I've seen written on the water crisis here in California. It appeared in the journal Yale 360, which is, of course, comes out of Yale University. And it talks about how you can bank or save groundwater, rural groundwater, in the agricultural areas. And there is, it's already happening in, ironically enough, in Arizona, neighboring Arizona, and California is now looking at ways that farmers, once they've used their water, can let it soak down into the underground aquifers and get credit for that, so that you set up a kind of an accounting system so that farmers know that, okay, if I don't waste the water above the ground but let it soak down into the underneath, I will get credited for that and I will be able to use it when I need it in drought year 2, 3, and 4.
Mark, given the power of the agribusiness and given the hostility, the political hostility to regulation, there's obviously little chance that any government, state or federal, would to start telling farmers that they must not plant alfalfa, they must not grow more almonds. And without that sort of decision-making process, the future is looking absolutely dreadful, apocalyptic.
California is going to face very difficult problems under climate change. That's indisputable. However, I'm not quite as pessimistic as your question implies, because for one thing, the population in California is broadly and deeply supportive of environmental law and regulation, for that matter. And second to that, I think that Jerry Brown in particular has the political ability, should he choose to do it, he has the political ability to turn this around, to really make water the focus of his final years in office.
Mark, I'm pleased to hear it. I've been an admirer of Jerry Brown's. You know, for decades, this guy's no fool, and he's a very adroit politician. And yet, as you say, he was late to come in with regulations, and when he did, they were inappropriate.
Yeah, but I think he's going to, I think that events are going to leave him no choice but to push further down this direction. And I think that this will be the defining element of his legacy. It's not the one he would have chosen, but this, as I said earlier, water has always been central to California's history. Jerry Brown knows that as well as anyone. And these problems can be fixed. Nobody is advocating, even among the very most sort of regulation-minded people, the point is not to say, oh, you can't plant almonds or you can't plant alfalfa. You know, again, I'm a farm boy. Farmers don't like that, and it's not necessary, and it's not intelligent policy. The main thing that has to be done is to set a realistic price. An environmentally informed price for what water really costs in the state of California. And then at that point, if farmers still want to grow almonds and the customers are going to pay twice or three times the price, well, that's their choice. I don't think that'll happen. I think that once we get real prices, that we will see the water consumption go to a level that is ultimately much more in keeping with the very severe climate change that unfortunately is now inevitable in this part of the world.
Some of the blame for the dire situation in California is being directed at environmentalists. I must say this echoes some of the things that are observable here. People arguing that green-style groups don't like bigger dams and reservoirs and haven't backed those desalinization plants that we mentioned earlier. There's no basis for this criticism, is there?
I believe you're referring to Ms. Carly Fiorina, the former business executive who's now recently thrown her name in as a candidate for the Republican nomination for President of the United States in 2016. She was quoted 10 days ago blaming the enviros for the California drought. And that, to be fair for a moment to her point of view, that the argument there is that, well, Mark Hertzgard and you other people who say that agriculture uses 80% of the water, that's not true because half the water is actually going to wildlife and fish and these kinds of ecological protections. Well, that is almost true. There's an awful lot of water that goes in that direction, but that's because those ecosystems are critical to the survival of the entire state's ecological and economic infrastructure. If you don't have those ecosystems in working order, everything is going to fall apart pretty quickly. And so, no, that's that. The problem is not that California is somehow spending too much money to keep fish in the rivers. The problem is that
are a bloody problem. You'd be better off without fish.
I mean, well, let's better be off without here, fish and all those other things. You know, but this is the thing. You know, California has essentially a 19th century water system, and we are in a 21st century climate change era. And that is the challenge for Governor Brown and all of us, frankly, who live in California, is we've got to find a way to bring our policies and our daily habits into accord with the scientific imperatives of climate change, which say that we're going to have severe droughts going forward. This drought that we're in now, we're in the fourth year, and the scientists are saying this could be the worst in 1,200 years. But they also say that if you look at the deep geological history of this part of the world, that it is common to have droughts of 10, 20, even 30 years in length. And that is the kind of future that we've got to be preparing for. I think we can do it, but we've got to think clearly about it and make bold and sometimes risky political choices, including taking on the Stuart Resnicks of the world.
Mark, I know you've got a daughter to feed, but one more question. You've reported on environmental issues around the world. You know what's going on in Australia, for example. In relation to water, is anyone heading in the right direction? Is any government managing the resource properly?
That is an excellent question. I think that there are individual, mainly local and occasionally regional success stories. I mentioned earlier that there was a fact-finding mission from here in California to Australia that looked at some of the things being done at the local level. But in general, I would have to say, sadly, that no, I don't see any nation state where water is being treated as the precious and irreplaceable resource that it is. But I think that the next 10 to 20 years are going to give us plenty of lessons as to why we have to get on that right away.
Mark, you're a great advocate, and it's a pleasure to talk to you. Mark is Mark Hostag is a journalist and author of the book Hot, very good title, Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. And I'm grateful for his time because he has, as I said, a daughter to look after. Good on you, Mark. The California drought, and I'm very sorry to say that that state, and indeed Australia, as another El Nino kicks in, isn't out of danger. That's a wrap for our little program. On our next, Roger Pulvers talks about how Japan changed his life. Stick around now for the news.